for your support. Coming up ahead is As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock this evening, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More at northhomes.org. Chance of showers tonight with lows in the mid-40s to low-50s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Aftershocks. An aid worker in Afghanistan tells us there are still areas unreachable days after the earthquake that's taken at least 1,400 lives. And people in the most affected places are not yet getting the help they desperately need.
And coming into fashion, Vogue has a new editorial leader, handpicked by Anna Wintour. The journalist who broke the news says Chloe Moll was a natural choice, but it remains to be seen if she was the right choice.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on KAXE in a few moments. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More at dalesautobodyinc.com. Let's listen to our album of the week. It is Hard Headed Woman by Margo Price. This is her fifth studio album. It traces her journey from dive bars to tour buses, showing an artist who never compromised her independence and authenticity. Her first tour date after this album release is none other than this Saturday at Grand Rapids River Fest. She'll be appearing with Courtney Barnett, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Here is Margo Price from the album Hard-Headed Woman. This one's called Love Me Like You Used to Do. It features Tyler Childers.
Let's go down to the bar like we did in the old days. We'll sit down, buy us a beer. I'll come over on coy like they do in the movies. What's someone like doing here? We'll use all our own lines. Don't I know you from somewhere? We'll pretend we're with somebody new. Call us a taxi, pull me into the backseat, and love me like you used to do. Whoa, love me you used to do.
Well, life ain't always roses. Let's forget all our woes and go out and pick up some wine. We'll come back to the house when we're all out of money. We'll have us a real swing in time. We work all the week. Let's call out tomorrow and do what it takes to get through. Maybe light me some candles, chase each other around, and love me like you used to do.
I know we do, and I believe. baggage and deceit and half-truths and lies.
All kinds of trust issues, empty boxes of tissues, and we won't see through each other's eyes.
Using drugs for the masses, rose-colored glasses, till we can't even see what is true. Throw it all on the bonfire, burn it all down, and love me like you used to do.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Shaky ground. Rescuers are still searching for survivors after the deadly earthquake in Afghanistan, which an aid worker says was only the first of several potential disasters to come.
Out of service, we'll speak to one of the growing number of Israeli army reservists who are refusing to take part in further military action in Gaza and risking jail time in the process.
A new spring follows winter. We knew Anna Wintour would be stepping aside after nearly four decades. Now we know who Vogue magazine has named as its head of editorial content.
Speaking truth to power, a friend and fellow actor remembers Graham Greene, who helped transform the roles Indigenous actors play on stage and screen.
A lack of transparencies as students return to school. One long-serving veteran of education is leaving. We will bid a fond farewell to the humming, humble, and illuminating overhead projector.
And mice work if you can get it. One candidate for mayor of New York thinks he can win by promoting his literal pet project, colonies of feral cats, to wage war on the city's rodent underworld. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that guesses his heart is in the rat place. The search continues for survivors of Sunday's 6.0 magnitude earthquake in Afghanistan. Despite having made it through the initial catastrophe, those survivors are far from safe, with winter looming and food, healthcare, water, and shelter in short supply. And the country's Taliban government is far from equipped to handle such a crisis. It's appealing to a cash-strapped international aid apparatus for help. Samira Syed Rahman is the Programs and Advocacy Director for Save the Children in Afghanistan. Today she visited communities affected by the earthquake in the country's eastern Kunar province. We reached her in Jalalabad.
Samira, I spoke with a spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council not long after the earthquake. They were in Kabul and they were describing how difficult it was to access the areas most affected. What did it take for you and your colleagues to get into those communities today?
You know, the worst affected districts are some of the most inaccessible in Afghanistan. These are remote mountainous areas where you have homes and villages that cling to the side of these hills and are essentially connected only by narrow dirt tracks. And even in normal times, reaching them can take hours or days. Now, with the landslides that have been triggered by the earthquake blocking the few existing roads, entire communities are cut off. Today, I tried to go to two areas. I could not make it to one of the most impacted areas because the road was completely blocked off. You had a traffic jam of volunteers who were going in to remove the rubble from the road with their hands. You had aid trucks coming in laden with food and resources that just could not make it through. We were told that it would take another 5 to 6 hours for us to be able to even get to the community that we were targeting. So we turned around and went to another area. You also have other areas that have only been accessible by helicopters. But we also heard of areas and villages where helicopters made several attempts to go, but simply could not land just because, again, the nature of the terrain. These are mountains that are very close together, valleys that are quite narrow. And those villages, you know, as time is ticking, we're getting into day three after this earthquake, and these communities have not been accessed.
In the places you were able to access, you and your colleagues, what are some of the things you saw and heard from families that stay with you the most now?
I visited one of our mobile health teams that we have set up in one of these valleys. And I sat with women, and every single one of them had lost 10, 15 members of their families. I spoke to one woman who said she had 8 children, 7 of whom died in this earthquake. And because the village that they were in was in such a precarious location, and due to the continuous aftershocks that are happening, they could not even get the bodies out of the rubble. They had to get out of that area and go somewhere safer, which was this valley. Again, in this valley, we also experienced multiple aftershocks while we were there. And just a couple hours ago, you know, there was another earthquake of just above like 5 magnitude is what I'm hearing, that was felt all the way up to the capital of Kabul. So as, you know, the rubble is cleared, that death toll and that the number of injured is just going to rise.
What is the likelihood? What's your sense that survivors might still be found at this point?
I mean, we're not giving up hope. We know of many incidents around the world where survivors have been found days after an earthquake. But at the end of the day, you know, this earthquake has struck a country that's essentially already on its knees. You know, these communities, which were the hardest hit, are also some of the poorest and most remote communities in the country before this earthquake. You know, families are incredibly impoverished. They're enduring, you know, flash flooding, economic collapse. And now in the middle of the night, their homes have crumbled around them. They've lost their family members. They've lost their livestock, their only source of income. And, you know, we've seen massive funding cuts over the course of the last year, which has put a particular strain on the health sector. The healthcare system is completely overwhelmed. Hospitals are overflowing. You know, there's not enough medicine. Medical supplies are running out. And unless urgent support arrives, you know, meaning more doctors, more medicine, more equipment, and essentially more funding, it's going to be incredibly difficult to keep that health system going and to ensure that it does not collapse under the weight of this emergency.
You mentioned where Afghanistan and its people were even before this earthquake, the economic crisis, the withdrawal of international aid as well, our listeners may remember, after the Taliban's takeover in 2021. The people of Afghanistan, of course, are not their government. They are not the Taliban. But what would you say to those who are reluctant, government officials around the world or others who are looking at this crisis, thinking how they can help, who are concerned about supporting in any way or appearing to support the Taliban?
When funding is cut, it is women and children who suffer the most. When the international community cut humanitarian and development assistance to Afghanistan, it was women and children that were impacted by this decision. And right now, we are seeing that once again. Women and children bear the brunt of the earthquake right now. They bear the brunt of the humanitarian crisis, the economic crisis. It is women and children that will continue to suffer as long as, you know, political decisions prevent humanitarian assistance from coming into this country. And when you have a situation like this where it's just one crisis after another. You know, on top of the humanitarian crisis, the economic crisis, we've also had 2 million Afghans who have been returned from Iran and Pakistan over the course of the last 6 months. And then now you have this devastating earthquake on top of that. No country would be able to cope with this. And the women and the children and the families of this country should not be punished for that.
Samira, I'm very glad we could speak. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Samira Syed Rahman is the Programs and Advocacy Director for Save the Children. We reached her in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. Before Graham Greene found his calling, he worked as a welder, a steel worker, and a roadie and sound tech for touring rock and roll and country bands. But in the 70s, he broke into stage acting, and that changed everything. The actor Graham Greene has died at the age of 73 after a lengthy illness. He started his life on the Six Nations Reserve in Grand Falls, Ontario. And after finding his way to the stage, he found his way to TV and movies, first reaching an international audience in 1990, co-starring opposite Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves, which earned him an Oscar nomination. After that, he never stopped working, appearing in nearly 200 movies, including Die Hard with a Vengeance, The Green Mile, and Twilight. In recent years, he appeared in Reservation Dogs and The Last of Us. But despite his stratospheric success, he stayed down to earth. Here he is talking to Tom Power on Q this year.
There's no glory in acting. It's, you finish your project, fine. People will see you as a two-dimensional character on a TV screen. But in reality, when you get home, who puts the pancakes on the table? I'm retired now. Getting my pensions. I don't really have to do stuff.
So now that it's not about the mortgage and the money anymore, why are you still acting?
Well, I guess it's like the old fire horse. You know, here's the bell. Out the door he goes.
Actor Tom Jackson was a frequent co-star and longtime friend of Graham Greene. We reached him in Upper Ten Talent, Nova Scotia.
Tom, matter of fact, he is there. And really, he sounds lovely. He was your friend, Graham Greene. When you hear that clip, where does it take your mind?
Well, it makes me smile. Yeah. I tell you, actually, every time I think of Graham, it makes me smile. I mean, I know this is a sad occasion, but at the same time, it's a celebration. I, in the last 24 hours, have been given the blessing of seeing and hearing Graham in my mind and my memories of having had his friendship. It's one thing to work with Graham.
Yeah.
It's another thing to have a friendship with Graham.
And you had to have both. So I'm so glad to have you here to talk about both of those things. Where did you two first meet?
Well, I met Graham at Theatre Passe-Marais in downtown Toronto. Mm-hmm. But he had already shot Dances with Wolves. And it was in post-production, but as a matter of fact, the funny part of it is I auditioned for the role. I didn't get the role that he got. But I met him, and when I met him, he was building sets at Passe-Marais.
While this and huge movie was waiting in the wings.
Yeah, he was doing sound, and he was building sets, and he was more the business than the business was him. And we went into this little bar called the Epicure. And there was a young lady that knew that he was Mr. Greene and came and wedged herself between he and I sitting at the bar and said, "Mr. Greene, what's your sign?" And he looked at her, thought about it for a second, and then he said, "Not to hay." Not to hay doesn't mean a thing. But that just is Graham. You know, just for the record, he and I take Not to Hay down the road. I've improvised it in films and television and shows, and he has done the same. So it's our little secret saying.
Oh, it's so wonderful of you to share it with us. So he got the part in Dances with Wolves that you had gone out for. How did you navigate that kind of competition in an industry that is tough for any actor, tough to break through, but particularly the barriers, certainly, for Indigenous actors at the time?
At the time, for sure, there was... it doesn't go unsaid, so I'll say it. At the time, a lot of Indigenous parts were played by non-Indigenous actors. Graham turned that around, and he brought that door and opened it, right? And that was, you know, we were trapped for a long time behind that door, but Graham unlocked that door. And but it didn't just unlock the door to the stage, it unlocked the door to paradise. Oh. Graham brought a generosity, not just as an actor. I mean, we had the opportunity to work in and on projects that were determined to help others, the end result, social enterprise, so that, you know, we could help people raise money for food banks. We could help people that were suffering from floods. We did a show called Halo High Water for the Calgary victims of the floods back in 2013. Yeah. But what I know for sure is that Graham's long-lasting evidence of a legacy that's worth following is not just a legacy. It's actually a future.
Reservation Dogs comes to mind, certainly. One of his last projects, hugely successful. Young Indigenous actors leading that, of course. They make up the entirety of the show, and it was so popular. And I hear what you're saying about that. I mean, to me, that is just one example of that future.
Yes. Yeah. But if you want to know the last thing that Graham said to me, mm-hmm. and I saw him in June, he was being recognized by the Governor General's Performing Arts mm-hmm. Lifetime Achievement Awards. And he and I, after the award show, mm-hmm. the room disappeared. You know, that was friends, right? Sometimes you don't see friends for a long time, and then it's like it was yesterday. Yeah. You just pick up and away you go. It was kind of like that. Yes. But we didn't just pick up. We shut out the rest of the room. And it was just he and I. I couldn't hear anything but his laughter. Couldn't hear anything but his jokes. He couldn't hear anything but my bad jokes and the silence that followed that. But the last thing that he said to me, he said, "I love you." It was the very last thing that he said to me. And I'm sharing that with you because I think perhaps the lasting thing that we can share with your audience is to ask them, in memory of Graham, to pick up the phone once we're done and call somebody to tell them that you love them, and ask them to call two people and tell them that they love them, and so on. And if we do this, if we do it tonight, by morning, we will have changed the world. In memory of Graham Greene.
I'm so glad you had that moment together, and you've been so generous, Tom. And I don't have to tell the listeners you just did, and I think they might heed your call. I so appreciate this, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you for helping me celebrate this. Have a beautiful day.
You too.
We reached Tom Jackson in Upper Tantallon, Nova Scotia. It is not not a scene from The Devil Wears Prada, but it kind of feels like one. And today, one of the most famous lines from that movie, "A million girls would kill for this job," is an obvious example of life imitating art. Vogue magazine has announced its new head of editorial content. It's not a huge deal for most other magazines. It's an enormous deal for this one, because after nearly four decades, editor-in-chief Anna Wintour is stepping away from the day-to-day operations of the publication, and to fill her impossibly stylish shoes, she has selected Chloe Mall, a fashion journalist and Vogue insider. Lauren Sherman is a fashion correspondent for Puck. She broke the story this week. We reached her in Los Angeles.
Lauren, almost as big as landing this job at Vogue is certainly getting the scoop on a story like this. So how did it come about for you?
So I've been following this since, you know, honestly, before Anna Wintour announced that she was stepping up, if you want to say that, or stepping aside from the running of the day-to-day at American Vogue. In the first piece I wrote, I sort of laid out the expected candidates, and Chloe Mall was definitely one of them. And I actually wrote in that piece that she was my bet, because Chloe just had the sort of background and she just makes sense in this position in particular, which is really operational. It's really in the weeds and it requires a level of ability to sort of manage up your reporting into Anna Wintour, who is not leaving the business, and then also showboating a little and being out there and having a personality. And I thought that she was a good fit.
You mentioned her background. Her mother is Candice Bergen, the beloved famous actress. Her father, the late director, Louis Malle. But you also write in your piece that she is the path of least resistance, unquote, because Anna Wintour is still staying around. But that's not a ringing endorsement necessarily, even if people support her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's complicated because it's sort of the most boring, obvious choice, but it's also in many ways the best choice. And now it's up to Chloe to prove that she is something more than an executor. The reality is she's going to have to prove, and her entire life she's had to do that, you know, as someone who is a self-proclaimed Nepo baby.
Yeah, she owns it.
She will say it. She has had to work really hard to prove that she isn't just getting favors handed out to her. And so I think now not only does she have to show that she's will show up to work every day, but that she also has a vision that is different from Wintour's, because every person that I've heard interviewed for this job said that the company really wanted someone who would have their own ideas. We'll see if that's actually true.
There are 28 international editions of Vogue published by Condé Nast. And when I look at, and it's not just me noticing this, but if you look at just British Vogue in the last two issues, Chioma Nadi is the editor there. Dochi last month, Michaela Cole this month, stunning fashion photography, more fashion forward, but also reflecting the diversity, not just, you know, people's backgrounds, but sizes and all of that. For those looking at that and wondering, what is U.S. Vogue, what is American Vogue going to be compared to that?
I honestly don't know. I think the UK culture, it's a much smaller culture than American culture. It is the way things like diversity and inclusion are addressed in British culture is very different than in the US. Obviously, we've had this like anti-woke backlash in the US. A lot of defanging of DEI initiatives at big corporations, and it's going to be up to Chloe to be able to communicate that in the magazine in a way that makes a lot of people feel like their point of view is represented.
The first Anna Wintour cover, many, many decades ago now, I was looking back at it, was seen as revolutionary because the model was outside. She was wearing jeans, and that was the first time jeans, I think, had been covered on Vogue. What do you think her Chloe Mall's first cover might look like?
Oh, it's interesting. Chloe is not a visuals person. She is a writer. And so I think it's really going to depend on who she chooses as her sort of partner in on the creative side. Anna is not someone who thinks, let's change the world. She thinks, let's reflect what's happening in the world. And if you look, if you fast forward to the Kim Kardashian, Kanye West cover from the mid-2010s, it was a similar thing of it felt kind of wild that she had done that. But the reality was she was just doing what she thought was right. And I think with the jeans, we look back now and that just seems amazing. She was also one of the first editors to really put a lot of celebrities on covers, which was a big deal back then too. What I hope for Chloe to do is that she does figure out a visual language that reflects the times. That's really challenging now. We're bombarded with imagery. She has a big opportunity. It's not the job it once was, but it's still a big job.
I wanted to ask you just finally, Lauren, tied into what you were saying there, you know, even if people have never picked up an issue of Vogue or they don't follow fashion, they've probably heard about Anna Wintour. They might have seen Devil Wears Prada. They know the Cerulean line. They quote it often. But do you think Vogue has the same kind of say and power that it did, that is reflected in that film and reflected in what we've seen from Wintour and the magazine in the past?
Definitely not. Anna Wintour's power has never come from the magazine itself. It comes from her ability to orchestrate everything outside of the magazine, bring tons of people, important people into the same room. If Anna Wintour calls you, you pick up the phone. No one else in the fashion industry has as much power as her in that way. The lucky thing is Chloe has the best brand in the world to start with. The hard part is, like, what does that mean today is anybody's guess at this point, and she's going to have to try to figure it out.
I'm glad we could speak, Lauren. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Sherman is the fashion correspondent for the news website Puck. She's in Los Angeles.
And I'm telling you, when I'm the mayor on January 1st of 2026, we're going to have law and order, public safety, quality of life, and I will do everything to lobby, to move, to get rid of no cash bail.
The voice of Curtis Sliwa, who might be the mayor of New York City on January 1st, 2026, if people embrace his policy positions, and if a majority of voters hate rats and love cats. And if all the ballots accidentally include only the name Curtis Sliwa, although even then it might be close. Mr. Sliwa is polling at around 17% right now. Since he founded the vigilante group The Guardian Angels in 1979, he's established himself as a real character in the city, which is another way of saying a lot of people think he's kind of terrible and or ridiculous. And his platform is very much the platform you'd expect from a Law and Order guy who created a group that no one asked for and who thinks red berets are cool. But one of his policies is surprising. He believes the city should establish another vigilante group to take care of New York's rodent problem, colonies of feral cats.
Now, this is Mother Nature's way of preventing rats, rodents, and others to plague any area of the city, especially parks.
Yeah, he was in a park at the time. Now, he's not just having this idea of establishing battalions of cats, catalions, if you will, to control rats. He's been talking about it for years. He loves cats. At one point, he had 17 rescue cats as pets. The last time he ran for mayor in 2021, he had trouble voting because he had taken a cat with him to the polling station and was not allowed in. So clearly, cats are his answer to a lot of different questions. It's not the worst idea, controlling rats with a nocturnal army of cats. We've agreed to call them catalans, I think. But it's not really the kind of idea that wins you mayoral elections. So once again, he'll probably be an also-ran, and he will confront that loss with mixed felines. Here's Penurged with Here Come the Warm Rats. This is Penurge with Here Come the Warm Rats.
We are going to take a short break now, but when we return, I'll speak with an Israeli army reservist who is refusing to take part in the war on Gaza, and he is not alone.
We will give you also a taste of the first and only ever band-approved translation of Bohemian Rhapsody into Zulu, and you'll hear an obit for the obsolete overhead projector. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Dave Murphy is your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music until 10 o'clock, and then it's more great music on Headwaters with Malachi Coons. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. We also receive support from the McKnight Foundation. We do have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, mostly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s to low-50s, and northwest winds 10 to 20. For tomorrow, 30% chance of rain and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, highs in the 50s with breezy northwest winds. Lows tomorrow night, 35 to 40, and for Thursday, chance of showers in the afternoon, partly sunny, highs 55 to 60.
The call to arms has gone out across Israel. Today, some 40,000 army reservists were ordered to report for duty as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pushes ahead with his plan to take complete control of Gaza City. But according to the Wall Street Journal, many soldiers are just refusing to show up. And today, hundreds of reservists signed a letter calling the war illegal. Roy Sommer is a reservist who's expecting a call up any day. We reached him in Greece.
Roy, jail time is a real possibility for refusing to show up to serve. Are you ready to risk that?
The short answer is yes, definitely. I realize that, like you said, what I'm doing isn't popular in Israel and could have circumstances, including legal circumstances. But I think the other option of agreeing to go along with this war, like it's currently being held, has moral circumstances, which I'm not willing to go with. In my opinion, the moral circumstances that are currently ongoing aren't allowing me to go along with the war.
You served as a regular soldier for 5 years, as I understand it, including in Gaza after October 7th. What was it? Was there a moment or a decision or a directive that made you say enough now?
I think the war in Gaza, like you said, has been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I was serving the war at a few different stages. The first stage of the war was much different than the other stages of the war, especially after the first ceasefire deal. For me personally, the thing that made me change my mind completely about the war was my experience serving in Gaza the last 3 months of my service. The war was a completely static one. Me and the soldiers on the ground, a lot of the times that we're not sure what we're doing there. The fact that we're on the ground isn't helping with the security issues of Israel, isn't helping us morally, it isn't helping the Palestinians, definitely not. And I think that the experience of being on a mission for three months and unsure of how exactly you're helping anything is really what created the situation where I changed my mind. I will say that I've never been a big fan of the current government, I've never been a big fan of the war, but I think that those last 3 months were what completely changed everything for me.
As you may have seen earlier this week, yesterday, in fact, the International Association of Genocide Scholars stated that Israel's conduct, Israel's policies and actions in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide. In November 2024, the UN called Israel's warfare in Gaza, quote, consistent with the characteristics of genocide, unquote, as well. Famine was recently confirmed there, and we know about the tens and tens of thousands of people who have been killed. If, and it appears that it will continue, what more do you think is going to happen if there is an expanded offensive?
I believe that the expansion of the current offensive will lead, first of all, to suffering on the ground, definitely for the Palestinians there, also for the hostages. There are currently 48 hostages, Israeli hostages, some of them alive, some of them not. The continuation of the war will also lead to more suffering on their side. And I also think that making this war go on and on and on with no apparent justification will lead to a situation where Israel, both security-wise, also internationally-wise, is being more and more secluded. And the Palestinians on the ground are suffering as it goes along. I think the plans, the final plans for some of the Israeli government officials are calling for something that is completely morally wrong, talking about Jewish settlements in Gaza, talking about displacing the Palestinians currently living there. And I think both sides of the conflict, the Israeli and the Palestinian sides, have nothing to gain from that. And it worries me a lot that the plans will go on as they currently are.
Netanyahu continues to argue that this new offensive is necessary to continue on Israel's mission, or his mission, as he said, states it, to destroy Hamas. I recall a conversation with an IDF spokesperson in very early October, right after October 7th, and he said in the pursuit of that stated goal, if hostages did not make it out, that was a line they were willing to cross. That was acceptable. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but they said if that's what has to be done, if that's what happens, that's what will happen to achieve our stated goal. Are you surprised, knowing that this war is still going on?
I think Netanyahu made very clear in the beginning of the war that he claimed total victory as what Israel is aiming towards, without clearly stating what total victory means. Mm-hmm. And it's something that he's been changing the definition of throughout the war. Sometimes it means complete annihilation of Hamas. Sometimes it means creating a new Gaza Strip. He's changing it in accordance with his political interests. And I think that's the only thing that is interesting him. Mm-hmm. And I think that when he realizes that the bringing back the hostages doesn't serve his political interests and doesn't serve the current Israeli government, their current interests, then he's willing to sacrifice them on the altar of continuing the current government, which is extremely unpopular in Israel. And they realize that. And that's part of the reason the war is going on, because they realize that once elections are held, hopefully, in my opinion, they'll be voted out. And I think that's the main reason the war is going on.
You're not alone, as our listeners have heard, in refusing to continue to serve. How, though, are your friends and family, or the people you've served with in the past? What are they saying about this stand you're taking now?
The dilemma that I've been dealing with the past few months is not my dilemma alone. And like you said, there's hundreds and thousands of Israelis that are dealing with the same dilemma. I won't lie, I definitely have been contacted by some friends who completely disagree with what I'm saying. I've also had friends who said that they appreciate my courage for speaking up and what I believe them in, even though they don't agree with it. And I've also had friends who say they agree with my opinion. And I think it's something that all Israeli soldiers in the current dilemma, and especially the ones that made the decision that I have made, have dealt with.
Ultimately, Roy, knowing what you know, what do you think would end this war now?
I think the war can end tomorrow, next week. It can end very quickly. And the only one that can decide if the war will end is Netanyahu. Sadly, I think that the only thing that is leading to his decision is not the interests of Israel, not the interests of the Israeli people, not the popular opinion in Israel, but what's benefiting him politically. It's sad to say, but the quickest way to end the war would be to find a reason to force Netanyahu to make that decision. And it could come in a few forms. It could come in the form of the protests in Israel, which have been going on for a long time, gaining popularity. It can come in the form of the Israeli military making a public stance against the war and making it even more well known than it is today that they are against it. And it could come in the form of a global outrage, which at the end of the day forces Netanyahu to make that decision. I can't say which one will come first, but eventually the war will end. The question is how many more lives on both sides will be lost before it happens.
Roy, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Roy Sommer is an Israeli army reservist. We reached him in Greece. The most popular song ever written about someone who killed a guy and then something really confusing happens involving Scaramouche, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. The ballad slash mock opera slash rock anthem, legendary for disarming and discombobulating listeners in equal measure, will turn 50 next month. Unlike many classics, it's been reinterpreted dozens and dozens of times in spite of, or maybe because of, its extravagant genre-bending weirdness. Over those 50 years, though, there had never been a Queen-approved cover in another language until now. A new Zulu version of the song has been released after the band's surviving members gave a South African choir the rare blessing to translate Bohemian Rhapsody. Here's the Ndlovu Youth Choir with Bohemian Rhapsody. Our sound of the day, the Ndlovu Youth Choir singing their Zulu version of Bohemian Rhapsody. Across Canada today, a lot of students headed back to school, and when they entered their new classrooms, they probably didn't even notice that something that was once considered crucial was missing, an overhead projector. That is the shocking reality that philosophy professor Paul Abella walked into when he arrived on campus at Acadia University to get ready for a new semester. He recently wrote a touching tribute to the overhead projector in the Globe and Mail. We reached him in Wolfville, Nova Scotia.
Paul, did you think the first thing you would write ahead of this new term would be an obituary, really, for the overhead projector?
No, it kind of caught me unawares, as it were.
So you walk onto campus and you paint quite a picture in your piece for the Globe and Mail of what you encountered when you walked into the building on campus. What did you see?
So I'm up on the third floor of the building, and I was coming in to start prepping for my fall courses. The halls were full of trolleys, and on the trolleys were these overhead projectors, probably a dozen, maybe a bit more. And it was kind of serendipity, really, because I was thinking about a course that I'm teaching in the fall, which is a course about philosophy in the information age. So it's very much about technology. And I think those two things going together, and then just looking down the corridors with these bits of technology on the trolleys, or gurneys, as I say in the piece. I was just struck, normally those halls are full of life and chatter and students and excitement. But at 8:30 in the morning, they're eerie and quiet. And it felt kind of like being at a funeral home after the guests have left and the body hasn't been moved yet. And I was just so struck by that image, and then also just thinking about that technology, which I remembered back in the Precambrian period when I was in grade school, and even in my undergraduate and graduate school. So I thought, well, maybe that little piece of technology deserves a kind of whimsical eulogy. So
I think a lot of people would agree with you. They were the height of technology at one point. So many people will remember them from their classrooms. There are other generations, obviously younger generations, who did not grow up with them. But maybe they kept them there for nostalgia until this point, or maybe just as a backup because the PowerPoint fails.
I mean, I think it would have been interesting to see either me or some of my colleagues flip the machines on and have a go at them. I mean, it is. I'm not a Luddite, and I'm not overly sentimental. But I was sort of taken by the just seeing them out there on their way out. That sort of rupture of a kind of pedagogical continuity in the classroom or in the lecture hall. That was really about 50 or 60 years old. Yeah. And of course, for the, you know, contemporary students, I mean, the students over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, current students who are coming back, for them, you know, they were probably oddities, maybe in a boring moment of a lecture. They might look over there and wonder what the heck those things were ever used for. But now their absence, I suspect, will not be noticed. And for the new students, of course, they won't notice when it isn't there. So it kind of does mark an interesting little moment of change in the classroom.
It really does. And it was an entire experience. Let's describe for our listeners how they worked. I mean, just and how they look. Sure. There's like a large box on the bottom and a swan-like neck, sort of, with the projector. They're not that ugly. Well, they're not
you're
small.
Doing a better, yeah, you're doing a better job than I could. Yeah, no, they were like a square box, probably 70 centimeters by 70 centimeters, maybe 50 deep. And they had a very powerful light in the base. And the light would shoot up ceiling-wise. And it would go through a lens, actually, in the unit. And those units and the lights really heated up. So they also had a fan, which, if anyone remembers from that period, had this kind of humming, sensuous sound. And the light would shoot up along the arm that you've described, swan-like. And at the top of that unit, there was a kind of triangular piece, and it had both a lens and a mirror in it. And it would shoot the light off at a kind of elbow right angle. So instead of going ceiling-wise, it would then shift. And you could put it up against a screen. And because it was a double mirror system, it was always right side up, and it wasn't inverted either. So it was a kind of go-to bit of technology in the classroom. And I certainly remember, particularly when I was very young and this piece of equipment was center stage, that, you know, the lights would go off, sheen would be turned on. It was a kind of, you know, Promethean godlight. There's the light shining. And it also pedagogically had a sense, you know, that something important was going to be shared. And maybe it was a bit of classroom theater, but however it played itself out, the sort of black to white feeling that came, and I sort of, in the rather whimsical eulogy that I offered there in the Globe, I'd say it's almost a quasi kind of religious experience. that it was, you know, it was a different moment in the classroom. And I think one little thing, and I'm not allergic to the modern technologies. I'm not a PowerPoint professor. Mm-hmm. I will put PowerPoints together for reviews before tests, but I'm still a chalkboard enthusiast. And the chalkboard property was also shared oftentimes with these units, and that was the ability to write in real time. So I think I put in the piece, I remember a grade 8 math teacher, and he's doing the calculations on the sheet in real time with the students behind him. They're looking, they're checking, they're hoping to catch him out, perhaps. And sometimes that was the case, and you'd see them lick the finger and erase.
Yeah, they would use a dry erase marker on the transparency under the light, yeah.
That's right. So that kind of real-time involvement was one where the teacher or the professor is at kind of one with the students. It's happening in real time. And one of the, and I know this can be mimicked in some versions of the electronic media, but generally speaking, PowerPoint lecturing and teaching tends to be a fairly static experience. It's that blue glow starts, the slideshow begins, and the students are to some degree thrown on the back of their seats because it's a passive mode of engagement. And one of the things that I frankly still like about the chalkboard, but also I remember with the overhead projectors, was that sort of real-time engagement, so that the students were a little bit more in the front of their seats than the back of their seats.
Well, Paul, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
No, but thank you for the call. I enjoyed it.
Paul Abella is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at Acadia University in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. Just 4 days into its maiden voyage in 1912, the RMS Titanic struck an iceberg and began to sink, disappearing into the North Atlantic Ocean. This is the moment, 73 years later, when it was finally seen again.
Oh, God, it's like a boiler! It's like a boiler!
Yes.
Fantastic! All right!
We're going to feel this, too.
I'm switching now, Bob.
Excuse my enthusiasm. Oh, yes, I'm sure it's a boiler. I see. Yes.
This week marks the 40th anniversary of the discovery of the Titanic wreck. After several failed attempts to locate the historic ship, Robert Ballard and his team of American and French scientists were finally successful in 1985. Although, at the time, finding the Titanic was actually a cover for a secret objective Mr. Ballard had been assigned. Here is Robert Ballard telling the BBC about the moment you just heard and the real purpose of his mission.
Naturally, your reaction is jubilant. You jump up and down and you're all excited. But then someone looked at the clock in the command center and said, she sinks in 20 minutes. And that innocent comment grounded us. We were embarrassed, quite honestly. Our feeling was, why are we celebrating? It spoke to us. We were at the very spot where all these lost souls had gone down and they were no longer lost. And I had the captain raise our vehicle above the bottom so we wouldn't hit anything. And I said to my team, I don't know about you, but I'm going out on the fantail. It was pitch black, just like this night the Titanic sank. Just stars in the sky, no moon. And we stopped the ship and we had to raise the flag of Harland and Wolff. And we had a quiet, reflective moment. I've been to a lot of places where terrible things have happened. But what was interesting about the Titanic was it was a morality play. It didn't sink right away, like the Britannic went to the bottom rather rapidly. Or it wasn't a ship of war. This was during the Edwardian era. You know, this was the wealthy were the stars of the world. And this play acted itself out on the deck of the Titanic. When I was trained as a combat infantry officer during Vietnam, you were trained to not really know the true measure of a person until it gets really bad. And in my case, because I've been trained to be calm, everything goes into slow motion. And you look around and the person you thought would stand the ground runs. And the person you thought would run stands the ground. And I think that that's what fascinates people about the Titanic. And it'll never stop because they wonder what they would have done.
That's got to be a big, big part of it. I mean, there's lots else in the story, isn't there? The hubris, the unsinkable description of this thing, the fact it was the maiden voyage. I mean, look, Robert, I just want to clarify some historic points here. You were researching these nuclear subs, which were lying at the bottom of the ocean. That was what was paying for your time on this expedition. And you weren't really able to tell your French collaborators, you weren't able to tell them, this is what I'm really here for. I mean, those nuclear subs, were they okay? Because that sounds like quite an important mission.
They had both shut down their nuclear reactors, so they went into auto-scram. One of the things we were doing was collecting animals that were living in the wreckage to determine if they'd been affected over generations. And it turns out the reactor compartment went into the bottom and sealed itself into the muds. It's not having any impact on the environment, but we didn't know that.
That was retired American Navy officer Robert Ballard, who led the team that found the Titanic wreck 40 years ago this week. He was talking to the BBC's Evan Davis.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on